Hello and welcome to Escape from Lockdown, the show all about how we got into this madness and how we're going to get out of it. Now, today's guest, I know every guest of mine is special and they're all totally brilliant, and today is no exception. Today's guest is a recently retired specialist in allergy and respiratory diseases and infections and a biotechnology CEO. But you might have seen him recently because he's been setting Twitter on fire with his excoriating posts, ripping apart the complete and total lack of scientific comprehension on the part of Her Majesty's scientific advisors and the government that pretends to understand them. He is, of course, Michael Yaden. Michael, how are you doing? Welcome to the show.
I'm doing very well. Alex, thank you very much for having me on your show. I'm very keen to get as much publicity as I can, not for me, but for my opinions, which I think objectively show the government is made just a complete mess of everything they are doing. And we can discuss some of that. But I'm very angry about what they're doing and its consequences.
Well, actually, that's a good way to start. Michael, tell me, why are you so... As you can maybe hear the traffic outside honking their horns, I think you're that angry. You have that level of pure
yeah,
anger.
I do.
Why are you so angry, Michael?
Yeah, so I've lived professionally a scientific life for, I don't know, 35 years since I was doing my research-based PhD in the 80s. And I'm one of these old-fashioned types that believe that science, the scientific method, is really what separates us from sort of the pre-Renaissance people who would manage healthcare and weather events through sacrifice and bleeding people and worrying about the color of your bile and so on. And I think once we stop allowing science to do what it can do at the right times, and instead start treating healthcare matters as if they're politics and that facts don't matter, then we start to get into the sort of trouble we're in now. So, my profession is being destroyed, really, because people are pretending that we're led by the science and following the evidence when it's clear we're doing no such thing. And then separately, forget my little personal concerns about what's happening to science. It's the actual facts of having made a complete mess, I think, of the oncoming wave of infection in whatever, February, March, April. Government just seems to have doubled and trebled down. Every time there was a chance to have stepped down with grace and to say, the worst has now passed, or, we don't anticipate, a return to the conditions of spring. Every single time they've played fear, fear, fear card. I think they're extremely badly advised by a group of individuals who might have been great for, responding to a nuclear contamination threat, but they're just hopeless where it comes to the spread of an infectious disease, the building of immunity by populations, and then also just looking at how many people have been infected versus how many have actually died, and just failing to do simple maths, which would tell you that this is now already very close to the lethality and public health threat of a rather unpleasant seasonal flu. But instead, they're pretending that almost everybody is still vulnerable. Everybody's got a lockdown, and ignoring the consequences of their quotes measures, and basically allowing more people to die as a consequence of the measures than they could possibly have saved, even if any of their measures had been successful, which, by the way, none of them are. And I also just don't see a way out of it. And then finally, maybe we'll come on to this, my present fear is that developments of vaccines are being accelerated for political reasons mostly rather than medical reasons, and the biggest fear is that we're going to end up in a situation with something like mandated or coerced forced vaccination of the population, and having to carry around health and vaccination status tokens on our phones, because I swear cleverer people than me think this would be a disaster, because it would never be unwound. That would represent a permanent transition of your control of your health and access to everything being at the behest of whoever has the database and the underlying systems. So that's probably enough. There's plenty of reasons to be cross, but those will do.
Wow. Well, I mean, how long have we got? So let's talk about SAGE, its actual full title, the Strategic Advisory Group on Emergencies. I want to make a little point about this. Every time you hear a acronym which makes a word, you're being played. So COBRA is the Cabinet Office briefing room, which is the government's emergency thing. There's no A in Cabinet Office briefing room at the end. They just put it there to make it sound more badass because it's like a dangerous snake. It looks like things are coming at you. SAGE, again, it spells out SAGE. So we think of a wise, you know, how could I say?
Yes, yeah, sagacious kind of, people.
Yes, yeah. Some kind of wizard on the top of a hill who dispenses advice. Could you tell me why that image is completely unwarranted amongst the participants of SAGE?
I can certainly do that. So, interestingly, you may remember at the beginning of in the spring, the membership of SAGE was secret, and so many things have been secret, even technical details are secret. But eventually, they were forced to reveal this list of names, and actually, it was not the only reason I think they kept it secret is because they were just a particularly unimpressive bunch of scientists, with a couple of notable exceptions. So people on SAGE that I have spoken to, and they know who they are, I think you're great. And most of the rest of you, especially you lot, keep appearing on the television talking nonsense about only 7% of the population have been infected. You know who you are, complete idiots. They are not qualified. I am more qualified to at least provide, I think, a rounded opinion as to what's happened. Also, I've spoken to a lot more better qualified people than me on the medical side, epidemiological side, but SAGE does not appear to have even the people with the right kind of skill sets to interpret what's happening. Let me just give your readers or your listeners one example that will make you fall off your chairs. In spring, all the way through the arrival, you know, the max deaths, and then out probably to May or June, the other side, SAGE did not have a single clinical immunologist on it. You never heard from a clinical immunologist, and they didn't have one. They do now. They've tripled the membership, and I think basically they've just gone on a tick box of every discipline, and they've just said, would you be on SAGE? And they've said, oh, yes, please, because, of course, it's a nice thing to have. But SAGE doesn't meet. There's 98 of them. They can't meet, not even on a Zoom call. But early on, they didn't have a single clinical immunologist, but they did have 7 modelers, people who do model.
No.
Well, you can only model that which you understand. But I'll tell you what. Ferguson's lot, and I really think he's an idiot, at Imperial. I mean, he's obviously an idiot because he's formed a model, and this is the theme I talked to you about earlier, Alex. He started with the notion that because it's a new virus, therefore there'll be no prior immunity in the population, which is a kind of a half reasonable thing to say. So his models start with 100% susceptibility, and they're still saying that today. Now, let me tell you why Professor Ferguson, who, by the way, has a training in theoretical physics. He's not a biologist or an infectious disease specialist. As far as I know, he might have an O or A level in biology, but I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't have that. And yet he leads this team that has put together this monstrous model that has monstered our country. So this is the first one. They started by the assumption that because it's a new virus, there was no immunity. So we'll start with 100% of us being susceptible. And this matters a lot because for various reasons you can compute from the R number, R naught, how easily the infection spreads and the initial level of susceptibility. You can work out what percentage of the population would have to become immune or infected before it would stop this sort of so-called herd immunity. And they calculated that was 65% or so. And of course, if the percentage lethality, you know, the number of people who would die per million infected, if they're numbers were correct, that would have killed 510,000 people. So he didn't lie in his projection. It was just completely full of garbage. You know, the input assumptions are demonstrably wrong before you even press go on the calculator. Let me just tell you why. No virus is ancestorless. Everything comes from something else. If it had come from the planet Venus, you know, maybe we'd have no recognition of any part of it and we'd all be susceptible. But this is a coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2. It's closely related to SARS-CoV-1. It's closely related to MERS and to 4 endemic coronaviruses, which together cause about 1/3 of the common cold. So most of us have been exposed to one or other of these 4 endemic coronaviruses that are very similar to SARS-CoV-2. And so, of course, we've got population immunity. It has been shown in at least 6 studies that are Oxbridge quality, you know, Karolinska Institute and things like that, Caltech, that between 20 and 50% of the population already had T-cell immunity to this virus because it's so similar to other coronavirus is causing the commons cold. So straight away, the Ferguson Imperial model that started with 100% susceptibility was probably out by twofold. And the really important component there is you don't need to have very many more people infected before the population as a whole is resistant to a wildfire, you know, expansion of the infection. And that's why it hit us hard in March. And we can now show by working backwards from the death curve, you know, we know how long between infection and death, to work backwards and infer the infection curve. The infection curve peaked and turned and was falling before lockdown. There is no question about it. It's not controversial in any scientific circle. But the government will have you believe that their action in locking us down saved hundreds of thousands of lives. And it absolutely did not. So that's the first mistake in the model. But it continues because I heard a SAGE member, and you know who you are if you're listening to me, who said to a friend of mine, and then he shared this conversation, that we had asserted that we thought the pandemic was almost over and we were seeing a secondary ripple at the moment, which will crest and go away. And the reason we thought that was true was that we'd done calculations and looked at the science from other theoretical epidemiologists like Professor Sunetra Gupta and others, that the percentage of people we estimated had been infected plus the ones who had prior immunity equaled close to herd immunity. And lo and behold, the infections turned over and fell and the deaths decayed to almost zero by July or August. And so when I then heard from a SAGE member that said, I couldn't disagree more with your assumption that we're near completion. I hope we never get to completion. He said, that will mean hundreds of thousands of deaths. Only 7% have been infected. And so what we need to do is keep us locked down for 6 months until there's a vaccine. We will end the pandemic through mass vaccination. That's someone on SAGE. Don't you find that frightening? I did.
Oh, it's like arguing with a brick wall. Ah, yeah. See, but the thing is, Mike, is that you must be wrong because I've got an article from BuzzFeed here. It says the right wing has a new theory for why the pandemic will end soon, T-cells. Because obviously the right wing is bad, and they couldn't possibly understand about... And actually, like, T-cells, they have various political beliefs as well, so they kind of think about how taxation should be spent, and only, like, good people don't believe such things.
You know? Right. That's, well, do you know, I don't even think I can comment about it. My daughter is far more politically aware than I am. And tells me so. My interest in politics has extended only to my citizen's duty of voting. I've never campaigned for anybody. I'm not even that bothered. I personally belong to the group that would be just tremendously pleased if we could have competent, honest administration. I actually don't even care what their political beliefs are at the moment. So I'm not actually sure I could define what wing I am. Can I just have competent, honest government?
Well, that's the whole terrible thing about it, because I mean, I think Orwell's great insight was probably loads of people thought this, but it's everything is political. You know, when he was told, I think it was put to him once, you know, surely some things should be separated from politics, and he said that in itself is a political point. But I mean, let me take another one for you. Before,
if you don't mind, the T-cells, just in case any listeners think that T-cells are political, okay, Orwell will say everything is political, but let me just be clear that, you know, T-cells can be isolated from circulating blood. They can sometimes group in particular tissues, certainly, you know, around your tonsils and other immune tissues, but they certainly are capable of, and do they take up a program, shall we say, when they've been exposed to a broken down piece of something foreign. So in this case, it'd be a virus, lands in your body, you have systems in your body that grab it, smash it up, and then process it and present it to the serried army of T cells that are kind of so-called pluripotential. They could do a variety of things, and eventually you'll find one in your pack of crack troops that fits and will respond to this broken up piece of virus. It's just clever molecular sifting at the DNA level before you were even born that gives you this capability. And so you have then some T cells that go, right, that's foreign. I recognize that. I know that you are you because you've given me the appropriate other signal. So I know this is a genuine signal from myself. that I've genuinely been attacked by something that I can recognize. And at that moment, that T cell starts to divide. It's called clonal expansion, and you end up with plenty of T cells programmed against that particular organism. And so they go about their work, and if they find cells infected with that virus, they instruct them to kill themselves. They go into a silent programmed cell suicide. So it's quite a neat programmed cell death, method of opposing infection. So once you've got these T cells, they tend to hang around for a long time. And I know of one particular example, the 2003 SARS outbreak. Clever immunologists this year went back to those people and asked them if they would donate some blood. And they found that their T cells in their blood from 17 years ago, they still had fully wide awake T cells ready to attack tissues infected with SARS and indeed SARS-CoV-2. So at least 17 years, it would be my guess, is probably effectively permanent.
I mean, that you cite a lot of examples and some studies there, but according to Stephanie Emily at BuzzFeed, it's just a right-wing conspiracy theory.
Oh, right.
So we'll have to let her.
I'll let her have her way. I don't know who she is. I don't really care.
There's another one that I want to challenge you, because it's kind of worth doing this, because we all know how Ofcom rules sort of state that only certain scientific opinions now allowed on television, which is nuts. So I was sent one here from Dr. Sarah Pitts at the Institute for Biomedical Science, appearing on BBC News. Turns out that herd immunity only happens with vaccines. Didn't realize that. Yeah, she's got some letters after her name though, Mike.
But she's just mistaken. I mean, how do you think? How does she think, or how would anybody listening to this explain why, when the first whatever in virus that was capable of killing the oldest and weakest amongst us, why didn't it carry on until we were all dead? And the answer is herd immunity. That's it.
Let's just call it schmerd.
Okay, but before we move off the Ofcom thing, you say we all know. You do because you're a professional, and I do because somebody made me aware of it. But folks out there, I think you should just take 5 minutes to read. If you Google Ofcom coronavirus broadcasting guidelines, prepare to be shocked. When I read it, effectively it said it cautions radio, TV broadcasters and all print media that such is the health emergency in this country related because of coronavirus, that we're telling you, you're going to have to be really careful about what views you give airtime, oxygen and publicity to. And if you have anyone on that is talking in a way that's in contradiction to either government statements or those of their authorized health advisors, you could potentially be in breach of these guidelines and could be fined or lose your license. And the more you read that, the more you think, actually, I think it's not too far a bigger point to say, in this regard, the coronavirus, you've got a freer press in Russia than in the UK. Mm. I've written to and contacted every major newspaper, radio channel and TV. Only one of them got back to me. It was Piers Morgan, because he hates the government. And of course, I didn't take him off on his kind offer. But no one else. And I'm I'm a professional scientist. I've published 60 peer-reviewed papers. I've run companies. I'm not a deliberate idiot. And I sincerely believe the government has made, at best, inverted commas, lots of mistakes. And I'm not even allowed to share this. I have to go to, I think this is great. I'm enjoying doing podcasts. I have to do podcasts, lockdown skeptics, or go on Twitter. And that's the only way I can get my message out. And of course, I've got 0.0001% of the share of voice of the official media. So that also makes me angry, that it's really difficult to get, you don't get a balanced opinion. That's why it's like a terror story all year. It's because the main media have taken a sort of editorial view, or maybe being guided by their in-house lawyers, that we better stick to the party line or Ofcom will break our fingers. That's really terrible.
Wow. So our understanding of the virus, the pandemic, is being affected by lawyers.
Yes, it is.
I rather sort of flippantly, very much laced with sarcasm, through a few sort of scientific statements at you there, and you very heroically sort of fielded them. But if we could actually move on to sort of serious issue here of we have this thing called SAGE, and you've very much excoriated them. But what else? What other kind of beliefs are we looking at here that are circulating around this group for which we pay, by the way? Let's just not be under the bush. Why are they completely diametrically opposed to reality?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I would, however, say that it's not for me to have to pull out a correct motivation in order to know that something is wrong. So I don't know why they're doing what they're doing, but in lots of ways they're wrong. I've mentioned this initial susceptibility being 100%, and of course the reality was probably less than 70%. But here's another one that follows from that, that when I realized this is what they were, you know, someone from Sage had told me this opinion, and I thought, my God, it's not just a line. They actually believe it. That's the official position that Boris Johnson and Matthew Hancock are being given. And so no wonder these people who are probably classics graduates or PPE or whatever, they're not STEM subject graduates. They're not, you know, they're adequately numerate. I'm sure they can work out their bank accounts, but they're not the masters of very large numbers, very small numbers, probability, conditional probability and the like. And why should they be? But if they get told by their lead scientists that actually most of the population of your country, you're in charge, are at risk of catching this and maybe 1% of them dying. So, you know, you've got to keep them wearing masks, socially distancing, washing their hands, not going to work. And so if that, I believe, is what Sage thinks. They don't all think that. I know Sir Pat Valance is far too clever to believe that. But the bulk of the people who are not immunologists or not epidemiologists, but they're modelers, or psychologists or whatever, that's what they've heard. And so that's the message they'll take, and you'll hear it on the TV. But so that means that they think we're only about 1/15th of the way through this. And so unless someone can persuade them otherwise, I don't think the British government is going to ever get advice to do anything other than what we're doing. They'll also logically think, since we're so many of us still at risk of catching it and dying, that of course it makes sense, regrettably, to have to force us to take the vaccine because we'll benefit from it. And of course, neither of those statements are true. We could lift all the measures today, respectfully, you know, be careful with people who feel vulnerable or are actually vulnerable. They're smart enough to know how to handle themselves. They've got through every winter where we have flu every year. So, but everybody else could just carry on. I think we're so close to herd immunity that it's as near as make no difference. And here's the evidence for the skeptics. You may remember in March which large conurbation almost caught fire with coronavirus. London. What's happening now in London?
Nothing. I can look out my window right now.
That's the thing. Crickets. It's that it's not ablaze with ill people. And the reason it isn't is because the virus has moved amongst them. It has made a small proportion of them ill, and regrettably an even tinier number have died. And the remainder have either, you know, got an immune response, or they had one already, or they have a powerful immune system, so that what's called, the automatic immune system is protecting them. But anyway, you can tell evidentially this population cannot support an expanding outbreak, because if they could, it would be here. QED. There's no other explanation.
Well, there is an explanation that's thrown at people. Like us who asked this, and it's simply that, it's the social distancing, it's the masks, it's the work from home. That's why not everybody's dead. So how could we...
How can I prove that?
Give our listeners some ammunition when they get this thrown at them.
Okay, at this point, so of course, I understand that. It's hard to believe that your government would lie to you, and it's a massive leap. For me, I'm just sort of a typical middle-class bloke. As I say, interest in politics was to check the budget and vote once every 4 years. It's a big leap for me to accept that the government was deliberately and persistently lying to me, you know, on TV, main event stuff, but they are. And I've mentioned the example of why London is not a conflagration of coronavirus, and I've explained why I think that's the case. You can't really, on the one hand, say London's protected by these measures, and at the same time, the northwest and the northeast, which are kind of furthest away from the London conurbation and had less intensive infection in the spring, that's why there's still a higher percentage of vulnerables. So you can't have, on the one hand, London's protected, and on the other hand, the periphery isn't. But here's the other thing. Infectious diseases that are really close in terms of transmission, symptoms and lethality, influenza, is transmitted normally right now. It's as intense as it is normally seasonally everywhere, including in London. And at the moment, roughly 7 or 8 times as many people are dying every day of influenza as compared with COVID. You can go and find that on any NHS website right now. And that wasn't true 2 months ago, 3 months ago. Mm. But now it has begun to arrive in the Northern Hemisphere. It's spreading through the community, even when we've got masks and distancing. You can't hide from that. It's the same route of transmission, very similar symptoms and lethality. There it is.
And talking about masks, I mean, that's one that really gets me, because I think I just want to scream sometimes when I'm just told, hey, it's only a mask. What's the problem? Yeah. It's only a mask. And, you know, for me, I think, I don't know if my listeners can tell when they hear me on this podcast, but my sinuses they're never clear. So it's just something I live with. But when the mask is on me, it's just harder for me to breathe. It sucks. Yeah. It's just something I've dealt with in every other situation. But why is it? I've always been convinced that masks don't work, simply because when we were told at the beginning, I just sort of looked around and just Googled randomized controlled trial face masks. Mm-hmm. Thought, oh, there it is. But can you tell our listeners why, in a more scientific way, why are these things utterly, utterly useless?
Yes, I can do that. Like you, I paid attention when our government and the WHO and others told us that there was really the evidence for protection of, you know, of another person or yourself by wearing a mask was weak. And that was true. The evidence, in fact, well, there wasn't much evidence, but what was there, in my opinion, was clearly that they didn't work. And the study, people can go and look up if they want to. There was a 1,500 person study 5 years ago. So it wasn't to do with coronavirus, but it was to do with respiratory virus transmission. 1,500 people who worked in and around a group of hospitals in Vietnam. And they studied them for a whole season, and they were randomized to one of three groups. They either wore medical masks, you know, the ones that you will see, you know, in, you know, most vulnerable people being operated on, or the kind of things we're now wearing, these little blue things or a piece of cloth, or as close to no mask as their shift patterns and personal choices. And,
yeah, out that control group, they did occasionally have to wear masks.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they
in that
healthcare
control group.
Yeah.
They did. So they were as close to no mask as you can get, probably half the time. And it turned out at the end of the year, and of course, remember, they weren't catching these diseases from patients. They were giving them to each other as they move around large hospitals, regional hospital groups. And it turns out that the people wearing no mask had the same frequency of influenza-like illnesses as the people wearing the high-quality medical masks. And the people who wore the cloth-type masks had twice the frequency of these symptoms, and it was laboratory confirmed. In other words, they probably are, you know, cooking up nasty cultures on their inadequately washed mouths and then inhaling fungi, bacteria, and what have you. So the objective evidence says it doesn't help and might make it worse. And from a theoretical standpoint, it's also unlikely. I worked in respiratory drug delivery for decades, and it's an incredibly hard thing to do, to create an aerosol of particles that are small enough that they will become entrained in your inhaled air and not hit your sinuses or the back of your throat and get swallowed, but actually flow down into your lungs. They have to be really, really small from an aerodynamic perspective. But the problem with that, from delivery both of drugs and of infective viruses, is that tiny particles carry almost no mass. You know, if you remember from O-level maths, the relationship between the radius of a sphere and its mass, tiny particles carry, you know, technical phrase would be bugger all mass. And so it's actually difficult to get enough sort of viral load into an airway by inhalation. So I'm not surprised it doesn't work, but I was guided by the empirical evidence that randomized controlled trials for me were good enough. And I just don't understand how, when we were kind of 90% through the coronavirus deaths, if you look at the daily deaths versus date curve, you know, we were right deep down on the bottom right-hand side. Why did they then introduce mandatory masks? It made no sense. And it just feels like because they can. You know, but it might be back to this idea that Sage thinks that 93% of us are still vulnerable. So, you know, crikey, Prime Minister, how will you be able to face the public inquiry if in the future lots of people die and you elected not to put in this measure? You know, it won't do any harm. So I think we've ended up, I don't think it's really to torture us. Some people have said it's a control measure. I just think it's a precautionary principle gone mad. idea, and it arises from Sage's misunderstanding completely of where we are in the pandemic. And again, I know Sweden is heavily political, but just for Christ's sake, you know, take the politics glasses off for a moment and just go and have a look. They're not dying. They're not dying. They're not looking down. They're not wearing masks. They're being reasonably respectful of distance still. They'll be a bit nervous, and there will be, you know, little ups and downs of coronavirus, no doubt. It'll still exist for a while. And they're now catching the normal seasonal other viruses, some of which will kill, you know, the old and vulnerable. But other than that, the society looks entirely normal. I'd swap it in a heartbeat for what we've got in England and France.
I mean, I'm cursed myself that if I could go back in time 10 years or so, I'd probably dedicate myself to learning Swedish just
good
so
move,
I could
yeah.
I could work there, you know. And I said this quite flippantly on Twitter, but if there are any kids if you're in the sixth form now, gap year in Sweden, you're going to have a great time because the universities are still going to be ruined. It's not just this year, it's going to go on. Just spend time there because you're going to have a lovely time, not HMP Great Britain.
Yes, HMP. Yeah, exactly. So one of my contrast points between what do I think Sage believes and what does reality suggest, and it's the interpretation of Sweden. I think Sage, denial. You won't get anybody seriously discussing it. And people who are not on Sage will say things like, well, you can't possibly compare Sweden to UK. And I think, well, why not? The reason I say you should is if you can be bothered to look at Our World in Data, OWID.com, you can get all the data, throw up the curves, daily deaths normalized for population, so like deaths per head per 100,000 people, and then do the same for Sweden and UK, and you'll find that the curves are almost superimposable. And there's a reason why that is, that although Sweden chose a fairly, you know, wasn't quite laissez-faire, but they didn't do anything special. And we tried things, but actually lockdown missed the peak of infection. So I believe all through the summer, we were identical to Sweden in what we were actually doing, regardless of what we said we were doing. And you can see the pandemic passes through their population and ours exactly the same, to the same day. You know, actually, you can see the shape and the curve, and they've had exactly the same lethality, 0.06% of their population have died. So same as ours. And theirs has stopped, and I believe pretty much so has ours. There's significant confusion in the results of so-called PCR testing, you know, the antigen testing on swabs. It's easy, if you wanted to believe the government was actually lying to you and deliberately, it's quite easy to create the sort of case numbers that they've got. And even if they're not cheating, there will be a small percentage of false positives, I think, given the volume of testing they're doing in people who are generally not symptomatic. And there's never any recognition that false positives exist. In every single test, there's a percentage. And government just weren't, we really forced it out of Matt Hancock. You know, Julia Hartley Brewer and I worked a number on him for about 2 weeks.
Yeah, it was brilliant.
And eventually he confessed, and then the ceiling fell in, because what that told me, and your listeners should be damn cross about what I'm going to tell you, during the summer, when almost no one was dying of coronavirus, that is, the daily death toll was getting lower and lower and lower, less than 1%, 0.5% of the daily deaths were caused by coronavirus. During that time, Valance and his team rolled out mass and increasing testing, so-called pillar two. They went out and tested hundreds of thousands of people a day. Now, if you do that when the prevalence of what you're trying to measure, the frequency with which the thing is in the population, at the time it was about 0.05, 1 in 2,000 to 0.1%, 1 in 1,000. If you've got a test that's got 0.8% false positives, for every 10,000 people you test, you'll get 80 false positives and you'd get 5 or 10 genuine positives. They knew that, and they rolled it out all summer, and they grounded out through the television screens every evening. And the only reason they could possibly have done that, given he's a clever guy, is to keep the drumbeat of fear going. It couldn't find cases because it overwhelmingly would find false positives. And they did it anyway. And when I realized that, that's when I put out that emotional multi-tweet that more or less called him a liar. And he said, if you think I'm maligning you, Sir Patrick, sue me. And you can do it again today, because you knew, pushing that test out in a low viral prevalence environment with a test that had 0.8% false positive, the only result you can get is 90% false positives, and you had the media grind it out every evening to frighten everybody. That's the only reason you did it. If there's another reason, let us know it, because I can't see what it was.
Well, it's well attested that very early, the psychologist on stage said, you know, we have to ramp up fear, which is I just think you're playing with fire when you do that. I think it's the
absolutely
most awful, cruel thing. And, you know, one of my little side things is I'm always sort of looking for evidence of that lockdown's doing damage. Obviously, I mentioned quite often on the podcast, I mentioned to you that I'm a relatively new father, 9 months, and stillbirths. This is really interesting because it's happened in lots of different places. It's happened in Australia, happened in one hospital in Britain, and it happened in Nepal. I think you can find somewhere else. They've quadrupled. And it's very clear to me that expected mothers aren't turning up to triage or obstetrics or whatever because they're being told there's a pandemic on, you know, you can't possibly do it. I'd argue that masks completely perpetuate that state of fear as well, because we're being told, go out to the tube, it says my mask protects you, wear it to protect me, you know. It is just, and also I think I disagree with you slightly on the mask thing. I'd say that it was a political thing in that one of the main reasons was to coax the economy back to life.
Yeah,
and, you know, that's working brilliantly, isn't it?
It didn't work with me. It didn't work with me because I'm a bloke. I didn't actually enjoy shopping that much. And once you added a factor that made it distinctly unpleasant, I just thought, you know what, I won't do it. And most things, I have to buy food, of course. But other than that, it's pretty much elective. So I just decided I wasn't going to do it. So well done. You know, now you've for every person you think you've coaxed back, you've got people like me who are just stubborn, and I'm just not doing it. So I just decided non-essentials, I'm not doing it. So
it's such a bizarre argument, because you only have to look on Twitter to see how maskers have a completely bizarre understanding of their effectiveness.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
They say, oh, you know, the reason why the Black Lives Matter protest didn't create, you know, a massive spike in coronavirus deaths was because of masks.
And
just for like a second to think about that, you just think, that's just ridiculous.
Personally, I elected early on not to include, as it were, masks in my main campaign. It was really just to focus on the spread of the virus, the evolution of population level protection. And partly it was because my compadres, one of them was in the NHS, and we started working together when a few months ago he noticed that the intensive care bed utilization in the NHS, once the COVID people either died or recovered and the beds were empty, they weren't refilled. And the intensive care bed use in this country, it's a precious resource, and it's nearly almost always used up, bar a little bit of overage for emergencies, in cases a plane crash or something like that. But it's been running cold all year. And you know what? Your listeners are going to be pissed off when they hear this, as I was. It's a deliberate policy. It's a deliberate policy to run the NHS cold all year and through and into the winter, because Sage tells them 93% of the population is still susceptible. I'm not kidding. Deliberately running, making NHS access difficult, not because they haven't yet got back on their feet. It's a deliberate policy to make it difficult because they think they need to reserve all this capacity, including intensive care beds, for when the next wave arrives, which is never going to come. But they're killing, you know, people in your family, your friends, your neighbours are dying, because somebody, including Hancock and whoever's running the NHS, they've decided as a matter of policy to run it light because we're going to need the capacity. That's what got me and my friend particularly motivated. We've been trying desperately to signal up the line in the NHS. We put together a position paper. We even got a very senior person in infectious diseases in the NHS to read it, and they said, actually, I think you've got it bang on. I'm going to, with your permission, I'll edit it, add my name, and then I'll use it as an internal document to go and see Professor Chris Whitty. Within 10 days, the person was silenced. We've never heard from them again. They've been silenced. They've been told, this is not for you to mess with.
Wow.
So there you go. Senior person. I won't name them. Not at all. I won't even mention the discipline, because they'd be in trouble. But I was just so upset when I realised someone has lent on this person and they've not come back to us. So the NHS is being run light everywhere. It's hard to go and see your GP. Dr. Professor Carol Sikora, who's a leading cancer specialist, has repeatedly, putting himself at risk, come on TV and radio. And he's one of the small number of fuzzy warm people that they will let in.
Yeah. And he's very soft on this. He's not as hardline as we are.
And he's pointed out that we know roughly how many people, well, people come to their GP and they've got a lump or a pain or whatever, and their GP looks at them and thinks, bloody hell, this could be cancer. Now, they're meant to have that thought a little more often than they actually have cancer, but, you know, you hope to get an urgent screen and it was a cyst or something like that. But that's normally how you get seen. You don't turn up at the hospital and ask them to do an MRI. You go and see your GP and they go, Mr. Jones, I've just written a letter for you. I'd like to take this letter and go straight up to your, whatever it is, your main hospital, and wait, and they'll scan you today. And when they do that, I think it's in the tens or hundreds of thousands a month. It's an enormous number. And of course, many are negative. But once that process stops, and it's pretty much stopped, all the people who actually have cancer will either be not diagnosed at all until they're in the terminal phase, or they will be diagnosed late, and in often it'll be beyond the help of medicine and surgery. So that decision to run the healthcare system light, both from primary care GPs all the way up to elective surgery and the use of intensive care beds, is allowing thousands and thousands of people to die for what? Because Sage, a bunch of, you know, whatever, inadequately educated people think something completely different from what every other knowledgeable person I've ever spoke to thinks going on in reality. And so it ought to be a political scandal. I just don't understand why more doctors in the NHS haven't come out. But, you know, my own contacts, you know, was clearly able to be scared off. But I know I couldn't live with myself. If I was a physician in the NHS and I had the insights I had had, I would have to speak about it. And I want you in the NHS. If you believe what I've told you is even roughly right, you need to do something, and you'll be followed by thousands of others. Because if you sit on your hands, you know what's going to happen. Sage is not going to change its mind. The NHS is going to be run cold all winter for something that's not going to happen. And your patients are going to suffer and die. And it's on your head. So do something. Otherwise, the reckoning will find you later.
Oh, yeah. Judged at some point. Because the key thing is also to say it's not just happening here. You know, Fauci, I believe, was questioned by Rand Paul, senator in America, about who's obviously reads the kind of same sort of stuff that we do. And you know, he questioned the 93% still susceptible, whatever it is in America. You know, he said, look, there's a lot of evidence to cross immunity of coronavirus. And Fauci just sat there and said, no, it's complete rubbish. I'm paraphrasing. It's basically, he just poo-pooed it instantly. I think Valence did in the presser recently as well. But, you know, I'm almost sort of shaking with anger here because it's just the ignorance is stunning.
The thing is, here's something that's very important. There's a good guy on Twitter I recommend you follow. Ruminator Dan. So Danny's a great guy. Now I met him on the email, shall we say, in real life. He's a really clever mathematician, and he made an interesting remark to me, which hit home. He said, with sufficient mathematics, he looks at the functions that are that underlie numbers in a way that I might look for patterns as a scientist, but he looks for underlying functions. And he said, I could tell and compute the size of the prior immunity in the population by looking at the shape of the functions. You don't even need to know herd immunity exists to see its effects on the pandemic. So there you go. You don't have to explain it through antibodies or T cells or witchcraft. He can observe the turning of the curve, the decrease over time, the commonality, the total number of deaths. You know, you can actually calculate infection fatality ratios that way as well. You know, there's lots of mathematics can do where you do, I can't understand it, I failed my A-level maths, but he was talking about transforming, you can do a double transform, and then you can start to pull out other functions. And when he did it, there were beautiful patterns that allowed us to conclude that we could actually start to make inferences about what the false positive rate was in the mass testing of PCR. And we even came to the conclusion there was a small contribution of what we call false COVID deaths. Get that? When they tell us how many people died of COVID in the last 24 hours, We have now tested 20 million people in the country, which is almost a third. Now, some of those people just will randomly die. You know, 620,000 people a year die in this country. And so that means, you know, it's tens of, it's whatever, it's several tens of thousands a month. And so once you've tested a third of the population, given that, you know, the virus, if ever present, can be detected for up to, we think, at least 10 weeks, you start to do the numbers on the numbers. And it's not surprising that a small proportion of people who die have had a positive test in the prior 28 days, but they didn't have the virus. They just happened to have been positive. And so there is a proportion of false COVID deaths in the statistics. I think that they will find out who they are later when they do a, provided detailed medical notes were kept. Coroners in the future will look back on this and be shaking their heads about how the hell did they conclude this was a COVID death? Well, it's because we've decided to call it that if you die of any cause and were positive in this PCR test in the prior 28 days. So just back to the point of the mathematicians, forget Fauci and forget me. Listen to the theoretical epidemiologists like Professor Gupta, listen to my friend, Ruminator Dan. He can show you of the effect on, of reducing population susceptibility. That's what it is. You start with a level of susceptibility, and as time goes on, that reduces. Most people survive, some have symptoms, and a tiny number die. That's unfortunate. Same with flu. But the remaining people are left immune. That's how the human immune system works. If it didn't, we would not be here as a human species in the 21st century. And there's no chance at all that this is somehow different from all other viruses, because it's closely related to lots of viruses that are in our environment all the time. One other observation I'll give you that your listeners can look at, this bit about second waves. So the Imperial model apparently does have a second wave, but its timing is March 2021, and it's twice the size of the peak we've already had. I don't know how they got there, because there is no underlying literature at all that suggests that viruses do waves, and in fact, viruses don't do waves. What we're probably seeing here at the moment with this, the case-demic, lots and lots of over-testing, but if we just forget the cases and look at the deaths, relatively small numbers, still far smaller than are dying all the time, at this time of the year, of influenza and pneumonia. And if you look, here's the thing to look at. Look at the slope of the rising number of deaths up from the baseline and compare it with the steepness of the rising deaths with time in March. It's much flatter.
It's like a ski jump and a little
ramp to get you into your shed or something. So, but this is the point, again, Dan and I were discussing, well, if you were now allowing the virus, or the virus was infecting a population that had not been completely intensively infected in March and April, what would happen is the virus would communicate, would be transmitted from one person to another more slowly because a smaller percentage are susceptible. Well, that's exactly what you expect. You'd get a small ripple with a flatter slope. I can't think of any other explanation. If it's the same virus and if it's still 93%, that's the same almost as 100. Why are the characteristics not the same? And the answer is because it's not the same setting anymore. That's something I've noticed. And so my interpretation, that of other people I've talked to, entirely in accord with proximity to herd immunity threshold, much slower expansion. But in terms of Sage's interpretation, I don't think they've noticed. They don't have an explanation. I don't think they've noticed slope is lower.
I think one of the problems is that because they're putting all these non-medical interventions on the population, which have never been tested before in a nationwide sample.
That's right.
So anything can be proved. And obviously, you said that there are several modellers initially on SAGE. There's probably about 30 now. They're only testing their findings against other models. So it's basically people are basically playing Street Fighter on computer against each other, being my character.
Yeah, that's
won.
Right.
To go on to the second wave thing as well, it's funny because one of the sort of seven deadly sins of lockdown zealotry, or I'll just say it, bedwetting, is to compare. To compare COVID-19 with the flu. But the only example of the second wave, and the second wave being larger, and I can tell you right now why Imperial modelled that in there, is because go onto Google, do an image search, type in Spanish flu waves. What do you see? You see a small initial wave and a really big second one. That's all it is.
102 years ago, correct.
Yeah, that's what they've taken it from. That's it.
That's right.
So apparently this thing is completely different from flu, but the only way we can possibly understand it is by looking at the Spanish flu, which, again, I read this before this all started, so that's how I know that it's not been infected with this kind of bullshit reasoning, is that the Spanish flu was completely evolutionarily distorted because we were moving enormous amounts of young men across France when somebody got... they were living in horrible situations, and when they got ill, they didn't stay where they were moved, which is the complete opposite of what happens anytime someone gets ill. So just... putting that out there. So
that's true. And also, I don't know if this is the correct phrase, but it seems to work for me. There's been some attempts at forensic virology, so looking at partial sequences from grave sites, frankly, of people who died in 1918, 1919.
Amazing.
And although we're not completely certain, I think the smart money in the sort of forensic virology area is that there was more than one organism. So it wasn't multiple waves of one infectious influenza, but more than one flu variant. So yeah, you could get 1 year a nasty wave that kills X percent, and then the next year you could have one that's much more severe, but it isn't a second wave of the same thing. And also, but here's the thing, rather than relying on 102 year old very uncertain data, why don't we look at the things in the last 20 years that where there have been SARS, which is a close, you know, a sibling really of SARS-CoV-2, one wave. MERS, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, didn't actually infect quite as many people, very, very nasty and lethal.
Yeah,
but again, no evidence of other than one wave in any particular geography. Funny that. You wouldn't intrinsically expect it. It's not mathematically likely. There's no underlying biology for it. As you say, the single example is the First World War for influenza, for which now the evidence supports could have been, or maybe was, more than one organism. And when you come to the most recent examples, definitely one wave each. So head scratch, you know, why would anybody, how can self-respecting, clever people, even if they're not immunologists, how can they not use Google and realize what they've got in their computer is junk? But if I could, this is very important to me because this is where the battle is now.
Yep.
Final difference between what I think sage view in their 3-meter concrete armored bunker and the rest of us out here protected by nothing but underwear and a mask, that the difference here is, I think, I've written here, importance of vaccine. And I think sage thinks it's essential to ever return the country to something approaching normal. Whereas I think optional. That is, I would hope we'll get one that's safe and effective. But if we don't, it's not the end of the world. You know, we don't have vaccines against lots of viruses, and it's regrettable, and we keep trying. But I think Sage thinks it's essential. And you can see now the tension between what I think should happen. I think, you know, once we've got a vaccine, if it's safe enough, effective enough, then although we'll have no long-term safety data yet, by definition, because we haven't had anybody that's had it and been around for years, but I think you could offer it to people who are elderly, vulnerable, and have given informed consent. That would be the key. You should never give a medical intervention to someone without informed consent. So I would want to offer it to people, you know, whatever. I'm not going to set the cutoff age, but maybe my age or older, I'm 60. So, you know, elderly people who are frail, maybe have got some other illnesses, maybe you had a terrible time of flu in the past and not died. You know, maybe those will be the people. You tell them what the risks are, tell them what the effectiveness profile looks like from clinical trials, and then say, if you'd like it, we would give that to you, but it's not obligatory. Well, I'm terrified that they're going to make it mandatory, or they will coerce us into having it mandatory. I can't see why anything like the number of doses have been purchased around the world. Can you? Why would we want several hundred million doses for a population for which 10% would be, I don't know, 6 million? If you dose them twice, 12 million doses, but we seem to have 10 or 100 times that many. Why? Well, there you go.
Anchoring.
Maybe it's because Sage has told them the only way you ever come out of this horrible nightmare is if everybody pretty much has got to get injected. And let me just tell people, you might be sympathetic to this viewpoint. Somebody might be. It's a way of ending it. Maybe it'll be safe. Let me tell you, after the Second World War, the UK, amongst others, was very influential in setting the post-war consensus in this area. And I can't remember the name of the convention, but I call it the Anti-Mengele Convention, for obvious reasons about the Nazi doctor. We made it illegal under international law to force upon someone medical intervention for which they have not consented. So do remember, if you ever hear Tobias Elwood talking about getting the army into the Sainsbury's car park and lining us all up, just tell him about this law. It's illegal. And secondly, you should never coerce or persuade someone to take a medical intervention for which they do not personally benefit. So if you're 35 and completely fit, you are not vulnerable to coronavirus. You're more likely to be run down by a bus or something like that, or fall down the stairs, you know, or kill yourself folding a deck chair, or something like that. But I'm cross about this. If they suggest to you that you ought to have this, you know, for the good of society, tell them you're not required to do so. And indeed, there is a law that prohibits them requiring you to do it. That's the message I want to leave.
They'll do it. I think the way they'll do it is, okay, sure, you don't need it, but if you want to go on a plane,
you know, exactly.
If you want to go to university, then you know, if you want to go to the O2 or whatever, you know, where's your little health pass?
Where's your little? Yeah, exactly. I would say that definitely fits in the category of coercion, and I think that will be subject to legal challenges, which I would personally support. I would be very happy to, if my testimony was of any use, I would offer it for free, because I think it's an important principle. If you let the executive push this on you, you will never have anything faintly approaching the freedom I had as a young man. Neither will your children or grandchildren ever.
I mean, I would almost argue in a weird way, maybe, because sometimes I think to myself, oh God, you know, if a vaccine came, then at least all this would be over. But I also think that maybe it, and I'm talking civilizationally, for the human civilization, which I say all the time on this podcast, has done great things, and there's many great things ahead of us that we've just got to go stand up and grab. But if a vaccine does come out next year, say, it will be a vindication of this awfulness. It will be a vindication of the worst policy disaster.
Yeah.
Ever, at least yes, since the First World War.
I think it's definitely the worst public health policy error in human history. There have been obviously worse deaths, but the First World War, of course, wasn't a public health policy. It had those consequences. But I think this has had no other drive behind it than allegedly to improve, you know, human health and well-being. And it's been I just cannot believe there's anything as bad as this ever in human history.
I mean, I would almost argue that the parallels of the First World War are quite strong, because, as we all know, the Archduke Franz Ferdinand got shot, and then what happened was all these countries were dragged into this thing, and they thought it'd be over by Christmas, and suddenly Russia declares war on Serbia, and then Germany has to get involved, and they start, you know, build, and before you know it, we're all in there, and a guest I had a few weeks back, Carl Venberg, showed how the countries just didn't know what to do, so they just copied the other in this domino effect. And now Michael Senger, who I had last week, was incredible, showed how you had the malign influence of China pushing this policy on people. You know, I think the similarity is absolutely profound. And we are still coming to terms with the First War. This is a really fun question. Hazard a guess when we paid off our First World War debt.
I remember being told that it was only a few years ago, something.
It was 2015.
That. Yeah.
Shocking. So you and I paid for that.
Yeah.
we paid for those trenches and those tanks.
Yes.
And that barbed wire.
Shocking. Absolutely shocking.
And our children, your grandchildren, probably my grandchildren, who are decades away, they'll be paying for this stuff as well. And I think we've only just begun to feel the effects. And so I feel that if no vaccine comes up, I don't actually think that it's going to save many lives, because after all, we've got that thing that rhymes with Schmerch immunity on the horizon.
That's the one.
And secondly, it will force all these people we've been talking about, Sage, whoever, the zealots and the bedwetters, to look themselves in the mirror and think, my God, what did we do?
Yeah, no, I agree. One part of me wants the vaccines to arrive because there will be some utility for the remaining, elderly, frail people with other comorbidities that might otherwise die of it. But at the moment, I think it's important to say that if you are characterized in that way, the thing that's most likely to stop you reaching spring is influenza. Because it's not yet gone anywhere near its peak, which will occur, I think it's December, January. So take care out there, but particularly take care in relation to influenza. You know, that's the thing that's the wave this year that, you know, would be at threat. If I was 10 years old or maybe a bit more, that would be what I'd be worrying about, not coronavirus.
Although I have to say, I think we're due a very mild influenza season. Yeah. I could be completely wrong, but the fact remains... The dry tinder theory, you know, sadly, a lot of that tinder has been burned away.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think, again, maybe your guests know this from other experts. But yes, if you, there is out there on the web someone who's plotted a graph on the one axis of the aggregate number of deaths of influenza for the last two winters on the one axis, and then the number of deaths from COVID on the other axis. And it's perfectly inversely correlated. So if you had lots of deaths in the last two winters from flu, you had very few deaths from COVID this year, and Germany and Greece are down there in the bottom right-hand side. If, on the other hand, you had mild deaths from flu in the last 2 years, you've had a horrible time this year, top left, Italy, Belgium, UK, Sweden a bit further down. So it's not the whole explanation, but most of the explanation has got absolutely nothing to do with government intervention. So all of you that love hating Britain, well, tough. You know, it's... It's not better elsewhere because they did it better, I don't think.
Also,
I think
it's
we've
worth saying,
gone through the motions. Yeah.
Who had quite normal flu seasons in the last few, couple of years? That would be Norway, Denmark, and Finland. Who
that's
had a
right.
harsh one? Who had a very soft one? It was Sweden.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
The whole discussion as to why somehow we're not allowed to compare. I mean, because I think the simple fact of we can only compare Sweden to other Scandinavian countries. Okay, well, why don't we compare US states to each other then? Why don't we compare Georgia, South Dakota? Why can't we compare those and find that these interventions did nothing?
Yes,
they did nothing.
Exactly. They did absolutely nothing, sadly. You've trashed economies. You've killed small businesses that several generations of hardworking people have spent, you know, their multiple lives building, and now they're destroyed. And some people will have killed themselves and others will yet do it. And all for nothing, all to defend the arses of our politicians and useless scientific advisors who should be absolutely ashamed of themselves. I'm ashamed for them.
Well, it's something to think about. Mike, you've been so wonderful as a guest and you've been so brilliant with your time. I don't know if you can tell, I don't normally get this energized from a conversation, but my God, I've just been so angry.
Well, I'm just thank you as well, Alex, for making this, you know, this channel available, because it's very difficult for people like me to do anything other than rave at my family and they've had enough, and then I've managed to get a few friends together, and then we're kind of working to prepare a few articles. We're just trying to put something out in The Lancet, which is one of the medical journals. But share a voice versus the BBC, I have no chance. So every day, if I can help to convert a small number of people who heard this and think, you know, that crazy guy, I think he actually had something to him. But that would then I have to thank you for making that possible, Alex.
And by the way, guys, listeners, please share this. I don't do as much as I should to promote this. I've been looking into ways of what I should be doing. But, you know, it doesn't hurt to pop it on Facebook, Twitter, or whatever, email it. I know that a lot of you do that, and I know a lot of it gets sent through text messages, which I think is great. Just do it, because ultimately, this is what we have. You know, it's spreading ideas. And right now, this is one of the most powerful. Simon Dolan, he's doing wonderful things with the court. You know, finally our MPs are starting to wake up. Thank fuck for that. Sorry about my language. But Jesus Christ, it's been long enough. So share it. Get out there. Don't stop. You know, because you can't, because it's too important for that. Mike, before I let you go, I just have one question that has been sort of on my mind throughout the whole podcast and since I read about it on Twitter. What was Pat Vance like as a young man, and how as you knew him?
I wouldn't say I knew him well. So the situation was, I had just finished my PhD, so I'm a postdoc researcher, and I joined the Wellcome Research Labs in Beckenham, and it was a beautiful environment. It was an old country home that had been the house of Sir Henry Wellcome of the eponymous trust. And so we had some labs down the side of this house, and they did great work there. You know, the people who worked out how aspirin works, I think it was Professor Sir John Vane, who worked there, I think they'd earned 3 Nobel Prizes in this tiny little set of huts.
Wow.
You know, in Beckenham. And it was fantastic. Then I couldn't believe how lucky I was. I remember saying to somebody, I like my job so much, I would do it even if they didn't pay me. And I think they gave me a slap. But anyway, I did wise up. But so I'd been there a few years, and then up taps this guy, Dr. Patrick Vallance. He was an MD. And unusually, very, very unusually, he was an MD doctor who wanted to do a research-based PhD, so he'd be a doctor, and that's what he is. He's a very mm-hmm. clever guy. And so he'd, I think I noticed, what I noticed was that he was ballsy scientifically. You know, he was very well read. You know, we could mount an argument. I can now, but not when I was 20-something. I was probably much more shy, but he could kind of get the attention of a room, and, you know, he would put together a thesis, you know, a hypothesis. This is what I think is happening that controls, say, microvascular circulation in the forearm. And then he would use himself and some of his lab mates as actual human subjects. I'm not sure you could do this anymore, but in the 80s they did. You would put catheter, what cannula in vessels and flow chemicals through and watch change in blood flow. And I remember being very impressed by the man, intellect, and also just sort of ballsiness of practical science, you know, doing science like that in the lab. And, you know, we were both working on the same kind of area. They just discovered that there was a factor called endothelial derived relaxing factor. It was a chemical. We knew it existed. You could show it existed in the lining inside blood vessels, but we didn't know what it was. But we had a very good idea. It was really fundamental to blood flow and cardiovascular control. And so Pat Vallance did some work on, you know, what the enzymes might be. And I did some work actually collecting what it was from exhaled air. So it was actually turned out to be nitric oxide, surprisingly. It's not been as rich a seam for drugs as we had hoped, but there are some that work in that area. In fact, Viagra vaguely works on this pathway. So it wasn't unconnected. And then years later, I worked at Pfizer while that was being discovered. So, but yeah, Pat Vallance was a more than averagely bright scientist doing an unusual thing, a PhD after an MD. And I thought, he'll go far. I remember people telling me he'll go far, and of course he did. So there you go.
But you,
anything else.
Well, but one thing that you've mentioned a couple of times is you don't think he's dumb enough to go along with this. You think that he might know.
Yeah,
I
must say, I was watching him do that presentation recently when he was showing us the swoosh graph, you know, that the doublings and doublings and doublings again. And my lip curled, and I thought, you don't believe that. So I felt like someone's got someone important to him, you know, in whatever, in captivity. And it's like, you know, do the presentation, Pat, or the kid gets it. So it's either something like that, or for reasons I cannot understand, he's willing to say things that I know he knows is not true. So I don't know, take your pick. It's just the most peculiar thing when you don't know him, but I know of him, have been close enough to, you know, shared a pot of coffee years ago. And here we are now. I'm a retired, they would call me a biotech, you know, entrepreneur or whatever. I did sell a company, and then he's a knight of science and the country's chief scientific advisor, and used to run R&D of our biggest pharmaceutical concern, GlaxoSmithKline. So, you know, no slouch. But how does he end up giving that presentation, and I'm here on a podcast on a wet weekend or whatever, wet Friday, telling the world that he, you know, he was not telling the truth. So what a bizarre world.
I mean, who'd have thought? I mean, just a few months ago, if we told each other, yeah, this is going to be. See,
that's right.
Mike, there's this guy in East London who's going to want to talk to you for an hour about your career 30 years ago.
And
Alex, you're going to be talking to this retired biotech guy, and you're going to get really angry when you do it.
Yeah, that's it would be exactly. Fundamentally, though, we would both be angry about the same kind of things. It's like, what the hell could that be? And we'd never work it out.
Yeah,
because I'm not that interested in politics. You're reasonably aware of the scene and so on. We would not I think we'd have struggled to put together a scenario that would have this conversation happening. So,
well, Mike, I'm glad that it is. Okay. You know, I think it's the most wonderful thing that we can connect with this, and there's so many great people out there as well. A lot of whom have been on this podcast, if I can plug it, and just, you know, like I said before, this is what we have. This is our fight. This is our battle. And we have to keep taking this battle to the enemy because our children's futures depend on it. This is simple.
Absolutely.
As that.
It does.
Mike, if people want to read anything you've done, get in contact, follow your socials, what's the best way? What's the best way to follow?
Best way is I do not block anyone following me on Twitter. So if you go to Twitter, I'm Michael Yeadon3. And so if you follow me, send me a message, we can be in conversation.
And it's extremely banterous and infuriating in a good way. I mean that they're furious with you, not at you. So
yeah.
It's worth watching.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's been absolutely brilliant. One of my real favourite ones. Listener, I think you'll have got about as angry at that as I have. But don't worry, there are more guests to come. I keep on getting people. And you can tell I said that I'd be more regular, and I am. So I think maybe we could all take some solace from that, and the fact that I just think, you know, I've got this podcast, you've got your Twitter accounts, you've got your Facebook accounts, you've got your friends, you've got your family. Don't stop. This is too important to stop, because they're not going to stop. They're not going to stop. So we have to keep going. Until next time, don't let this shit get you down. Bye-bye.